Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. The role of an umpire and a judge is critical. They make sure everybody plays by the rules, but it is a limited role. Nobody ever went to a ball game to see the umpire. Judges have to have the humility to recognize that they operate within a system of precedent shaped by other judges equally striving to live up to the judicial oath.
Chief Justice John Roberts at his confirmation hearings in 2005. He's right about the fact that no one goes to a ball game to see the umpire. But the analogy falls flat when it comes to the attention being paid to the United States Supreme Court. And increasingly, Americans do not like what they see. The Supreme Court's approval rating plummeted in the past year. In a Gallup poll just last month, only 40% of the public approved of the high court, a drop of almost 20 points in 1 year and its lowest score since Gallup began polling the question in the year 2000. In addition, about 60% of the Gallup respondents said the court is too ideological. The disapproval is shared among self-identified liberals and conservatives. Well, the high court justices are berobed in black and cloistered in marble, but they are not immune to tectonic shifts in public opinion held by the nation they serve. So in recent weeks, they've been making their own oral argument before the people. Justice Stephen Breyer on the PBS NewsHour.
It's a great honor to be a federal judge. It is a great privilege. And one of the things that comes along with that privilege is that you are there not for the Democrats, not for the Republicans, not for the party of the president who appointed you.
On September 12th, Justice Amy Coney Barrett said at the University of Louisville, quote, "My goal today is to convince you that the court is not comprised of a bunch of partisan hacks." On September 30th, Justice Samuel Alito at Notre Dame slamming the media for an effort to, quote, "damage the court as an independent institution by portraying the court as having been captured by, quote, a dangerous cabal that resorts to sneaky and improper methods to get its ways." September 25th, Chief Justice John Roberts speaking in New York, quote, "When you live in a politically polarized environment, people tend to see everything in those terms," he said. "That's not how we at the court function." Well, in fact, it's a defense Roberts has been mounting for quite some time. Here he is in 2017.
It is very difficult, I think, for a member of the public to look at what goes on in confirmation hearings these days, which is a very sharp conflict in political terms, in Democrats and Republicans, and not think that the person who comes out of that process must similarly share that same sort of partisan view of public issues and public life. That's very unfortunate because we in the judiciary do not do our business in a partisan, ideological manner.
And then there's Justice Elena Kagan in 2018.
The court's strength as an institution of American governance depends on it having a certain kind of legitimacy, on people believing that it is not simply an extension of politics, that its decision-making has a kind of integrity to it that is something different from what you find in the political branches. And if people don't believe that, they have no reason to accept what the court does. And that would be a great shame.
And then there's then-nominee Amy Coney Barrett at her confirmation hearings in 2020.
A judge must apply the law as it is written, not as she wishes it were. Sometimes that approach meant reaching results that he did not like. But that is what it means to say that we have a government of laws and not of men.
And Justice Clarence Thomas at Notre Dame, September 16th this year.
I think the media makes it sound as though you are just always going right to your personal preference. So if they think you're anti-abortion or something personally, they think that that's the way you always will come out. They think you're for this or for that. They think you become like a politician. And I think that's a problem you're going to jeopardize any faith in the legal institutions.
So fascinating, because Thomas, normally so reticent in the court's regular proceedings, freely offered this opinion, saying the public is partially to blame for luring judges toward the temptation of legislating from the bench.
Those of us, particularly in the federal judiciary with lifetime appointments, are asking for trouble. I think a lot of the pressure on the nomination and selection process is because of that. I think the court was thought to be the least dangerous branch, and we may have become the most dangerous.
Well, this is on point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and here's today's question. Doth the justices protest too much? What if the Supreme Court is, has always been, and will forever be not floating magisterially above political interest and ideology, but very much a part of it? Dirtying the hems of their robes, slogging through the political mud with the rest of us. Well, Randall Kennedy, professor at Harvard Law School and author of the new book Say It Loud on Race, Law, History, and Culture. Professor Kennedy, it's great to have you back on the show. What do you think? Are they dirtying their robes in the political fray? And have they always been?
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's wonderful to be with you. I'm really glad that you gave a lot of space and time to the justices to allow the audience to listen to them put forward their case, because their case is so self-discrediting. I mean, are we really supposed to believe that their individual preferences don't have an important, sometimes decisive effect? Are we really supposed to credit what Justice Clarence Thomas just said? Are we really supposed to credit Justice Breyer talking about how the court is above politics? I think that they are showing themselves to be politicians in the very way that they're acting. So we have this public relations blitz on the part of the justices in an effort, obviously, to try to lull the public into a state of complacency. What they're interested in is their authority. To quote Justice Breyer's book, the authority of the court and the peril of politics. They're concerned about their authority. They're concerned about how they look. They're concerned about their legitimacy. They're not so concerned, really, about a realistic view of the way in which they comport themselves and the way in which they shape our law.
Okay, I am so excited to have this conversation, because I have been rubbing my hands for a while to really talk about what's at stake here, which is the function of the law in this country. So let me bring in Jack Beattie. He's with us today as well, On Point News analyst. Hello, Jack. And I want to give you
Hello, Meghna.
Hi there, Jack. And I just want to give you a first swing at this, and go ahead.
Well, first of all, it's such a pleasure to be on with Randy. And if I may say so, his book, just out, Say It Loud, Essays on Race, Law, History, and Culture, is a clinic in how to think in writing, how to think, how to argue, how to use logic without attitudinizing, without virtue signaling. He makes exquisite distinctions dealing with the most sensitive subject in American life, race. And yet it's not bloodless at all. It's animated throughout by a cantless commitment to common decency. So I salute his book and you, Randy.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Well, you know, this case that the court is political is made most powerfully, most recently, by Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator from Rhode Island on the Judiciary Committee. In a book, in articles and law reviews, in op-eds, and notably in his presentation at the confirmation hearing for Justice Barrett, he outlined what he called a scheme. And he shows how through the Federalist Society, the Judicial Crisis Network, and other groups, $250 million in dark money has gone to reshape the American judiciary. And what happens is that the dark money donors give this money to these groups, Federalist Society. They use it to orchestrate Supreme Court appointments, to advertise the person running appointed to the court, to send amicus briefs to the justices. Millions of dollars spent on this. And what has this all this money wrought? Well, what it's brought is this. From 2005 through the fall of 2020, and I'm quoting now Sheldon Whitehouse, the Roberts Court issued 80 5-4 partisan decisions benefiting big Republican donor interests, allowing corporations to spend unlimited money in elections, hobbling pollution regulations, enabling attacks on minority voting rights, curtailing rights of organized labor and workers who are challenging employers in court, and, of course, expanding the reach of limiting the rights for people in civil cases. 80 cases, 5-4, all coming out on the side of Republican donor interests. Pretty substantial indictment, what you could call bias, in one direction, and that's one reason the court is under such public criticism now.
Well, today we are talking about, we're exploring this question of whether the Supreme Court is and has always been a political institution and not the impartial umpires of the law, as Chief Justice John Roberts would have it. What do you think? Let us know on Twitter and Facebook. And as we head into the break, let's listen to Justice Stephen Breyer from back in 2017 recounting how the famous Oliver Wendell Holmes defied the president who appointed him.
Teddy Roosevelt appointed Oliver Wendell Holmes because he thought Oliver Wendell Holmes would be a secure vote for his view of antitrust. Within 4 months, Oliver Wendell Holmes had come out the other way, and Teddy Roosevelt said, "I could appoint a judge with more backbone carved out of a banana." He was furious. He was furious. A president who thinks the judge is always going to decide his way is really under some kind of cloud of delusion.
Back with more. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're asking the question of whether the Supreme Court is, in fact, political or ideological. And more importantly, has it always been that way? And if so, what does that mean about how we, the American public, ought to view the function of the court in American democracy? And we're getting a lot of comments online already here. Diane Fitzgerald says, "Lady Justice wears a blindfold. It seems that now the Supreme Court justices do not." And Guy says, "Congress can pass laws and take the heat off the courts, but few politicians have courage to do that, and or they are paid off by special interests." I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst, and Randall Kennedy, professor at Harvard Law School, author recently of Say It Loud on Race, Law, History, and Culture. And Professor Kennedy, I would love to hear a little bit more from you about the ritual function of the court and how even in its proceedings, the black robes, the marble pillars, the oye oye is supposed to position in our minds that, yes, indeed, this is the Article III branch of government that is supposed to be above, floating magisterially above, as I like to put it, the dirtiness of day-to-day politics. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Sure. You mentioned some of the ritual, especially the Supreme Court of the United States. It's part of our civil religion, and actually there's a certain sort of religiosity that surrounds the court. The idea of it being some sort of clerical operation. This is very deeply ingrained in our public life. We speak about journalism. It's a journalistic convention to refer to the presidency as a political branch of government, the legislature, the Congress, as a political branch of government. But the court is something else. And in fact, we heard some of the justices, they're complaining that that journalists are now portraying the court as on the same level as the other branches of government.
Well, it seems to me that's completely
proper. It's completely proper to when they're describing, for instance, a series of votes, it seems to me completely proper to say, who were the presidents who appointed the justices? The justices are complaining about this because they like being viewed as, mysterious, off, in their own, behind closed doors. I think it's a very good thing that there's more demand for transparency and that there's more demand for realism.
Okay, so
that is what we should be demanding.
So let me just jump in here because I think the justices have had their hackles up about this for a long time. And you see it even in the confirmation hearings, confirmation hearings should be deeply subject to criticism and analysis themselves. But here's Neil Gorsuch in his 2017 Senate confirmation hearing, and he's speaking with Senate Judiciary Chair, then Chair Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa.
I'd like to have you describe in any way you want to what judicial independence means, and specifically tell us whether you'd have any trouble ruling against a president who appointed you.
That's a softball, Mr. Chairman. I have no difficulty ruling against or for any party other than based on what the law and the facts in the particular case require. There's no such thing as a Republican judge or a Democratic judge. We just have judges.
Randy Kennedy, you hear Gorsuch there talking about, almost the monkish remove that the justices have when they ascend. I love using the words around the high court, but ascend to the high court. And that therefore also we as the public are supposed to somehow view their rulings as beyond reproach. But you've also written very, very, very specifically, so gloves off now, Professor Kennedy, about how you don't even think that we're sending our best to the Supreme Court.
No, I don't. I mean no disrespect. I think that the people on the Supreme Court are, generally speaking, good lawyers. But the idea that they are the most learned people in the law, the idea that they are the most skillful, the most capable jurists, no, I don't believe that. And with respect to their rulings, I think that their rulings should earn respect. I don't think it's just because somebody has been nominated by a president and has been confirmed by the Senate, that should not impel my obedience. They should earn respect. and they should earn respect from a public that is watchful, from a public that reads what they write and that scrutinizes what they do and that is appropriately skeptical of what they say. All of that, again, requires a realistic attitude toward the justices, a realistic attitude toward law.
Okay, so let me ask you this then. Has the Supreme Court always been political? You clerked for Justice Thurgood Marshall in your legal career. Was it political back then too?
Absolutely. And to answer your question directly, yes, it has always been political. It was political when, Adams and Jefferson were fighting. It was political when the great Chief Justice John Marshall was creating judicial review. Of course, it's always been political. And when you talk about dirtying, I don't think that's the appropriate way to view this. It's not as if the politics are dirtying. The politics are just part and parcel of lawmaking. The Supreme Court is a lawmaking branch of government. And that's just the way it is. It's not a matter of it being dirtying. That's just the way it is.
Mm. Well, we're going to bring in another voice here in just a second. But Jack Beatty, there is a difference, though, between a Supreme Court that is political versus a Supreme Court that is ideological. Is there not?
Yes. And I think that's where the expansion of Chuck Schumer some years ago really opened up this debate. He said, we just can't look at qualifications and publications and background. We also have to look at the justices or the putative justices' ideology. And so now that is a constant in these hearings. What are your fundamental sort of beliefs beneath your doctrines? And they don't get to it very well, but it is now on the table that ideology is a criterion to whether I'm going to vote for this justice or not. And so you routinely hear people like Senator Coons recently at the Barrett hearing saying, this is an outstanding person, good record, all the rest. I think her ideology is wrong. I think she's just going to take us in the wrong direction because of this underlying commitment to values that we call it prejudicially ideology. So that's a crucial part now of political of Supreme Court appointments.
Mm. Well, Randall Kennedy and Jack Beatty, hang on here. Let's make a little bit of room for David Cole. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and national legal director for the ACLU. He's argued 7 cases before the Supreme Court, briefed many other cases that went before the court as well. Professor Cole, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So you've been there, standing before the very judges whom, admittedly, we are taking to task today. What's your response? What's your pushback to this assertion that the Supreme Court is always and has always been political and the judges shouldn't be getting, flustered by that?
So let me start with an area of agreement, and that is that Randy Kennedy's latest book is fantastic. And I love Jack's description of it as a cantless commitment to common decency. Ever there were a perfect blurb for Randy Kennedy, that would be it. That's where we agree. I also agree, of course, to some degree, the court is political. These are human beings. They grew up in the world. They got appointed through a political process. But I think it's all too easy to just sort of condemn the court as political and partisan. And I think it's really important that we maintain the ideal and the striving for precisely what the justices are all talking about, which is that they should decide cases based on application of legal principles, not based on partisan gut judgments. And, they don't always succeed, Absolutely, they don't always succeed, but they succeed more often than you might think. And here's the critical point: if they didn't try to do that, if they acted just like members of Congress, then every decision would come out 6-3, Republican Democrat, or 5-4 when it was five Republican appointees and four Democratic appointees. Certainly every important decision will come out that way. That's certainly how it comes out in Congress, and nobody questions it. You know, the Republicans vote Republican and the Democrats vote Democrat. That's what they're supposed to do. But that's not what justices are supposed to do. We appoint justices because we want them to defend principles that go beyond the moment, go beyond partisan politics, that defend those who are unpopular, which are not going to be defended by partisan politics. And that requires a kind of commitment to not vote your partisan gut. Do they succeed? Yes. So 3 terms ago, the court decided 16 cases by a 5-4 margin. 8 of them were decided with the 5 Republicans in the majority, but the other 8 were decided with the 4 Democrats joined by one of the Republicans. Each of the Republican justices joined the others at least once. 2 terms ago, in all the court's biggest decisions, the liberal side won. DACA, the elimination of DACA. Roberts joined the liberals and struck down the elimination of DACA. Extension of Title VII to gay and transgender folks. I argued that case. It was written by Justice Gorsuch, joined by Justice Roberts. Trump subpoenas. Trump said, I'm above the law. I can't be bound by these subpoenas. The court ruled against him 7-2, with the Trump appointees voting against the man who appointed them. And then this past term, with the first term with a 6-3 court, there were very, very few 6-3 decisions. And in many of the most controversial cases involving religious freedom and gay rights, involving the Affordable Care Act, involving the protection of speech, the court sought ways to reach consensus and did not divide 6-3. The religious freedom case was unanimous with the liberals joining the Republicans on a very narrow ruling. The Fakir case, which again I argued, we won 8-1 with the liberals and the conservatives largely together. The Affordable Care Act. So I just think it's too simple to say they're just being political and they're just being partisan. We should criticize them when they are, but we should not lose sight of how important that ideal really is.
Okay. Professor Cole, point well taken here, and I'm going to want responses, of course, from Professor Kennedy and Jack Beattie as well. But, you know, even in just how you described the court, describing them as liberal and conservative justices, I mean, that flies in the face of what Justice Gorsuch was saying in that tape we played from his confirmation hearing back in 2017. He says clearly there's no such thing as a Republican judge or a Democratic judge. So, I mean,
there's a difference between liberal, conservative, and Republican and Democrat.
Okay.
These days it becomes, you know, and I think Roberts is actually right. These days when we are so hyper-partisanly divided, it becomes difficult to maintain that distinction, but there certainly is a distinction between those two things. And again, you know, when a member of Congress votes party line again and again and again, nobody objects. If a justice votes party line again and again and again, we should object, and we should, check to see whether they are doing that. Because if they're doing that, they're not doing their job. If they're acting just as politicians, then we shouldn't have people with life tenure or independence. And we do in many states. We have judges who are elected because people think it's better to have them elected, responsible to the people. That, I don't think that's a better system. Mm. What happens in those systems is that justices are unlikely to rule for criminal defendants, unlikely to rule for unpopular speakers, unlikely to rule for minorities, because they know that's not what will get them reelected. What will get them reelected is voting for the majority view, testing the winds, and going that way.
Right.
That's not
Can,
how justice
I'm going to just jump in here, Professor Cole, if I may, because we're going to talk about sort of alternative means of putting judges on the bench here. But I want to give Randall Kennedy, we just got about a minute and a half, Professor Kennedy, before our next break here, but respond to David Cole's, you know, spirited defense of the court.
Well, I think that he is making the realistic view of the court too simplistic. No one is saying that the justices just do what they want, that they, you know, wake up in the morning and just want to vote a certain way, that they act on whim. No one is saying that. Presidents don't do that. Members of the House of Representatives and senators don't do that. Everybody is constrained in certain ways. All I'm saying is that the justices, like everybody else, have preferences, and that their preferences, the policies that they want to see implanted in our law, that those preferences, those desires, those results play an important role in their decision making. Is it the case sometimes that there's some rule, some very specific rule that might prompt them to retreat? Sure. But if they've got a chance, they are going to try to put in our law what they want.
Mm. Randall Kennedy, Jack Beatty, and David Cole stand by. We are talking about whether the Supreme Court is, has always been, and may forever be political, or whether, as David Cole says, that's too simplistic of a reading of the function of the high court in our democracy. So much more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about whether the Supreme Court has always been a political or even ideological institution in American democracy. And we're asking that question especially in light of historic low public approval numbers of the court. Just 40% of Americans in the most recent Gallup poll approving of the job that the United States Supreme Court is doing. That's the lowest number it's been since Gallup started asking that question back in the year 2000. But we've got some more supportive views of the court coming in here online. Ian Bender says, if the general public is unhappy with the court, it means the court is generally doing its job fairly well. And Ray Russell says, don't blame the court, because Congress should be the catalyst when it comes to controlling political influence. The court merely decides the constitutionality of the issue. And of course, legislators don't want their influence pipeline stopped. I'm joined today by Randall Kennedy, Jack Beatty, and David Cole. And I just want to take a second to talk about some other models that are used to get justices onto the bench. And David Cole had mentioned this a little bit earlier, because one of the ideas behind lifetime appointments on the Supreme Court is that that appointment would insulate the justices from politics. And of course, we're debating whether or not that's true. But let's take a moment to look at the states where judges are mostly voted on or off the bench. And so are those judges more partisan? Well, Miriam Seifter is professor of law at the University of Wisconsin and co-leader of the State Supreme Courts Project. And here's what she has to say.
There is some level at which state courts, at least some of them, are more partisan, which is that some of them run in partisan races with a D or R next to their name.
And her research suggests that, yes, politics can influence how they rule.
We have two systems of electing judges that are not designed to produce pure apolitical rulings, right? One is appointment by elected officials and another is selection by popular majorities. So it's probably true that in certain types of cases, particularly those where there is not a legally obvious answer, politics is one of the factors that affects judicial decision making.
But surprisingly, Seifter says there are downsides and upsides to having the judges elected to the bench.
The biggest downside may be the well-documented effect that judicial elections have in criminal cases, especially when combined with the effect of big money. And that is that judges seem to become harsher on criminal defendants before they have to face voters. So that's a clear negative. On the positive side, being accountable to statewide majorities may mean that state courts are a way to sort of temper and be a popular check on extreme actions by other state actors, especially gerrymandered legislatures or other state officials that happen to do very unpopular things.
And she says you don't have to look very far to see that being tested right now, specifically after the 2020 election and the dozens of failed lawsuits alleging voter fraud with no proof that were brought by the Trump campaign.
So there were probably more than 50 cases filed in the wake of the election. And that included judges at the federal level appointed by both parties and judges at the state level who are more affiliated with both the Republican and Democratic parties. The courts rejected those challenges. And I guess in that way, they, you know, showed that courts can, to some extent, temper the extremes of partisanship.
And finally, Seifter says that the way that elected judges come to the bench in various states may not be perfect, but neither is the way justices are appointed to the Supreme Court.
If we assume that judges are sometimes susceptible to politics and are likely to be responsive to the political actors who selected them, then it's problematic to have judges who are selected by a Senate that doesn't correspond to the wishes of a majority of voters in the nation, and in some years, a president who can be elected without winning the popular vote. And so the idea would be that then the rulings that they reach don't sort of have the imprimatur or the blessing of what a majority of the nation should want. It's problematic if they're systematically not corresponding to what people want.
It's Miriam Seifter, professor of law at the University of Wisconsin and co-leader of the State Supreme Courts Project. So, David Cole, let me turn back to you here. Professor Seifter there really laying out the case that it's not the court that may be the problem, but the hyper-politicized other branches of government. What do you think?
Well, I don't think there's a way to appoint justices that is devoid of politics. You have to make a choice, and we give that choice to the president with confirmation by the Senate. I do think it's a concern that the Senate, because of every state gets two senators, regardless of their population, is heavily biased in favor of the rural states, and therefore a majority of the Senate often reflects minority views, and that often is also true at the presidential election process. That is a serious problem with our Constitution. It's going to get worse over time, and it infects the judiciary, infects everything in our system. But I think the solution there is I'm not sure what the solution is, but it may be rejiggering the Senate, not getting rid of the ideal that judges should decide cases, without a resort to partisan preferences. And I don't mean to say, Randy said, of course preferences play a role. Of course preferences play a role. Justices have worldviews, just like we all have worldviews. They wouldn't get to be justices if they didn't have worldviews. But those affect their decisions. But that's not impermissible. What's impermissible is if they vote on party line. Not impermissible for a member of Congress, absolutely impermissible for a judge or a justice. And that is an important distinction for all of those who care about protecting civil liberties, protecting civil rights, protecting the rights of minority groups to maintain.
But Professor Cole, how do you tell the difference between preference and party line?
Well, when I went to law school with Randy, actually, and we learned that in law school, that there was a realist critique. The justices are just driven by their gut judgments. It's all kind of superstructure, but really what drives them is their preferences. I then went to clerk for a judge who was a Republican appointee. He had been the head of President Nixon's reelect Nixon campaign in Pennsylvania twice in a row. And then he was appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals. And I consistently had experience with him of going in with him to talk to him about a case where his gut judgment was to go right. And if I could demonstrate that the law actually required him to go left, he went left. And, I, you know, Justice Roberts is another example. Chief Justice Roberts is no fan of abortion. He is a deeply committed Catholic. He would never have decided Roe versus Wade. He dissented from a number of the abortion decisions. But 2 years ago in June Medical, he voted with the liberal justices to strike down a restriction on abortion because it was the same, essentially the same restriction as one that had been struck down several years earlier in a decision that he dissented from. And so even though he disagreed with that decision, he went along with it because his role as a judge was to apply the law as it had been decided, even if he disagreed.
So let me turn back to Randy Kennedy here, because this leads to what I think is the natural next question, which is, I hear Professor Cole talking about how the system has worked, for sure. But again, if we have hyper-politicized executive and legislative branches of government, let's just focus on the Senate here for a second. Does it not lead to judges ascending to the high court, becoming justices who are in fact less likely to distinguish between preference and party line, that the ideological extremism in the Senate that we're seeing has to but de facto bleed into and is bleeding into the Supreme Court?
I don't accept the importance of the distinction between partisan thinking and ideological thinking. There was a time when, for instance, you had liberal Republicans, but conservative Democrats, but you know that's contingent. Again, my point is that these lawmakers, these judges who are lawmakers, lawgivers, they have agendas, they have preferences, and they push them. You know, you were talking about Justice Barrett. You know, Justice Barrett's comments were made in a particular setting that I think is quite noteworthy. She was speaking at the McConnell Center, celebrating Senator McConnell, whose machinations made it possible for her to get on the Supreme Court. And then she's going to tell us that, of course, she and her colleagues are not political. Well, excuse me. No, I don't believe that. I'm not going to go for that. And I don't think that the public should either.
8 days, in fact. Right. She became a Supreme Court justice. A very rapid ascension there. Jack Beatty, I know you want to get a word in here. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to get David's response to Sheldon Whitehouse's critique, which is just briefly that the Roberts Court since 2005 has had 85-4 partisan decisions benefiting, quote, big Republican donor interests in four categories: unlimited money in politics, diminishing the civil jury, weakening regulatory regimes, and fourth, weakening voting rights. What do you say to that, David? Isn't that bias? Isn't that political bias?
Well, I don't know that it's bias. It's disturbing to me. I wonder how many 5-4 decisions went the other way, though, that Sheldon Whitehouse did not mention. The court recognized marriage equality, 5-4. The court struck down DACA, 5-4. The court extended protection of Title VII to gay and transgender folks, 6-3. It's just not as simple as that statistic, which does not talk about the other 5-4 decisions that came out in a liberal direction, and there are significant. I mean, since 1972, the court has been a majority Republican-appointed court. Since 1972, for 50 years, in that period of time, the court recognized that discrimination on the basis of sex violates the equal protection. It upheld affirmative action. It struck down laws making homosexual sodomy a crime. It protected marriage equality. It struck down the death penalty for juveniles. It struck down mandatory life without parole for juveniles. So it's just not that simple. That's a Republican majority court. If it was a Republican majority Congress, if the justices were voting the way politicians vote, I don't think any of those decisions would have come out that way. Mm. So I think you have to. I think it's too simple, and I think it's dangerous. If we give up on the idea that justices should try to, apply the law and not be driven by their own political judgments, then what is to constrain a 6-3 court? What is to constrain the court, for example, this term, overturning Roe versus Wade, which is what Mississippi has asked it to do in the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Center case.
Professor Cole, can I just jump in here? Because we only have 2.5 minutes left, and I want to get a chance for Professor Kennedy to have another word in here. But what is to constrain the court? That is exactly the question, because I think in some recent rulings, we've seen that the normal honoring of stare decisis, the justices, when convenient, have just tossed it out the window. So what is to constrain the court?
Well, that's exactly it's this ideal that constrains the court, the notion that they have to show humility, that they have to look to what the justices have decided before, that they are bound by stare decisis in all but extraordinary cases. Look, if abortion rights are upheld this year, it will be because of stare decisis. It will not be because the 6 Republican-appointed justices believe that Roe versus Wade was rightly decided. It will be because they will believe that it is not their job to change the law simply because they now have the votes to do so. And that would not be the case if they were a totally political body. That would not be the case if Congress were given that decision.
Okay, so Professor Kennedy, just got a minute or so here left to go. And I actually want to close with the notion that you have mentioned before. And that is that the law, in fact, is a distillation of our politics. That's a quote from you. And that is the case, right? So therefore, does that not make what Justice Amy Coney Barrett was saying earlier that I quoted her, saying that that the judges are not partisan hacks? Because as laws get created in this country through that distillation process, through the process of Congress when it functions and a president that finally will sign something into law, that we essentially do get the purest intent of the people. And so therefore, if the justices honor that law, honor the politics that led to that law, there are these guardrails built in. And so perhaps we should just stop worrying and learn to love a political court.
I think that the court is political and that we should understand that and therefore live with it. I guess ultimately the one difference between David Cole and me is his sense that of the bindingness of the law. The law is capacious. It is malleable. The law is everywhere. And you can do lots of different things with the law. So I don't think that, there's law over there somewhere and that it's some sort of mysterious force that's going to compel the judges to, do something. They are going to do what they ultimately want to do, and they are going to justify what they do by reference to, quote, the law. But we should understand realistically what the law is.
Randall Kennedy, professor at Harvard Law School, author most recently of Say It Loud on Race, Law, History, and Culture. Professor Kennedy, always a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Likewise, a pleasure, Jack. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Megan.
And David Cole, professor at Georgetown University Law Center and national legal director for the ACLU. Professor Cole, with gratitude, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Megna.
I'm Megna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.